crypto will consume every single industry in the world.
I'm Sonia Morton Firth, and you're tuned in to the Sonia Morton Firth Show. Today, my guest is Steve Woody, Army veteran, crypto investor, gamer, and author. In this episode, we take you through a step-by-step guide into crypto. Meme coins, how and what to pick. Bitcoin price prediction, and what altcoins are the next ones to fly. Welcome to my show. I am super excited. How are you doing today?
Hey, Sonia, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm doing really, really well. Thank you very much.
Well, I know we've got loads of things to get into because, well, things are going parabolic, as they say in the industry. Bitcoin has gone way up, and we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of that. But before we get started, why should my audience stay tuned to the end? What are they going to learn from this conversation?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I like to set expectations, and I think it's really important. And so I'm going to be honest up front and throughout. And I think that's quite rare in this space because a lot of people are in it for themselves. I've got nothing to shill. I've got nothing to offer, nothing to sell. There's no button to click. There's nothing here. It's just, I don't want anyone to get wrecked. I've been wrecked. I know people that have been wrecked. And so whilst I can't promise you I'm going to make you money or that you're going to do the right thing, hopefully by the end of this, you'll have an understanding that when you look at what you're doing, you'll be able to do it with the perspective that will hopefully help you to stop you getting wrecked.
That's great. And I think there's going to be a lot of people out there right now that are going to get wrecked.
100%.
That's simply because there is so much going on. People don't understand crypto. They haven't taken the time to educate themselves. And of course, with massive headlines like you can make millions or meme coins flying all over the place, it's very tempting just to take a little dabble. But look, we're going to go into a few of the do's and don'ts, but let's find out a little bit more about you, Steve. Can you give me a little bit of your background and how you got to your crypto investing days?
Yeah, sure. Okay, I'll give you the quick story. So my claim to fame, I guess, is I was actually involved in crypto before Bitcoin existed. So I was involved in crypto back in 2001. We used to use it to send secure communications through satellite when I was in the army. So through the British military, we used to use a system called Ptarmigan. So I was involved in crypto back then. It's very easy when you see the charts and you look at what was, and from the comfort with hindsight to say, I would have done this and I would have done that. But when you're in that moment with your money, it's very different. And so when Bitcoin first came out, I liked the concept of it. I loved the idea of disrupting the financial markets, but I didn't believe in it enough to put money into it. And so I didn't actually buy my first Bitcoin until 2014. I was quite late to the party. Obviously now by that standard. But the other thing as well, and this is the other thing that people don't realize, is it's very easy to buy something, but then knowing when to sell it. And I bought my Bitcoin when I was married, and then I sold it when I got divorced. And so I didn't hold it long enough. And I learned my lessons through that. So I was early to the table in terms of awareness, but in terms of action. And I think that's really important. That's a key thing we'll talk about today, I think, is knowledge is potential power. It gives you the information, but if you don't act on that, and knowing how and when to act on that, that's the key. And so I didn't actually pull the trigger and jump into crypto until 2020. And I started trading some coins. Only really as an investment. It was around the time COVID was happening. I'm in the UK. So if anyone knows NS&I, which is where you have your premium bonds and they do ISAs for savings accounts, they kind of got wrecked and they announced they were going to destroy all of the interest rates and premium bonds were going to get nerfed. And so I was looking at somewhere to put my money outside of the traditional savings. And I just didn't feel like premium bonds were a good enough way. So I took the 50,000 I had, because that's the limit that you can have. I took it out of premium bonds. I put it into crypto. And very quickly, because I was at the start of that bull run in the last cycle, I was making more in a month in crypto than I was making an entire year in my company. And I realized that this was a real thing. So I doubled down. I got into Web3 gaming because I thought gaming would be the key to mass adoption. I hired staff, and I was effectively paying thousands of people in the Philippines to play computer games. And we were getting commission from that in the form of crypto that we were selling. And at the peak, we were doing 100,000 a month. I mean, it was incredible. And this is, you know, I took a 50,000 investment and I spun that up to, and it annoys me because I got 970,000 on the balance sheet, which is just shy of a million. And I wanted to say I was a millionaire, but I couldn't, not like in myself, it wouldn't have been true. And so then the bear market hit and we all got wrecked, myself included. Good lessons to be learned there. And that almost seven-figure portfolio went back down to five, low five figures. And I went through, I would say, probably some of the most mental and emotionally challenging times of my life, learning about how to deal with loss in that regard. Because I think when you spend your entire life struggling with money like I have, I've been bankrupt, I've been homeless, I've had to build myself up from the ground. So when you get to that stage where you finally feel like you've started to make it and it gets like pulled away from you through your own fault, I had no one else to blame. It's very difficult sometimes to rebuild again. But that's kind of where I got to, where in the last 2 years, I've just rebuilt everything. And I've managed to, thankfully, through nothing more than just grit, determination, and hard work, through the bear market, I've managed to build up to seven-figure portfolio again. And now I'm positioned for this next bull run. So it's been a journey. It's definitely been a journey.
It sounds like such a journey. And there's so many things there that you said. I mean, you said bankrupt, homeless, army veteran. There's a few things there. It sounds like, Steve, you've been right down at rock bottom low in your life, and then you've climbed back up. I'm just going to go there a little bit. Do you think the magic, what do you think your secret is?
I know what the secret is. It's very simple. I'm a donkey. I'm stubborn. I'm a mule. I just refuse to give up. There's no secret. There's not, unfortunately. I just refuse to give up. I'm just so stubborn that I just won't let it beat me.
Okay. You won't let it beat you. And are you taking that into this bull run?
Hopefully with a little bit more foresight. Yes. I'd like to think that I'm a little bit more educated now. I think everyone that's been through a cycle or two has a different outlook on things. I don't let the emotions play as much as they used to, because don't get me wrong, they were there. And I was doing some very degenerate stuff. I mean, we were staking money that was providing 80,000% APY. I mean, it was insane. Like, what happened in the last few years was ridiculous. And you can say, oh, it's not real money. But I mean, that money that I cashed out paid for my life. You know, I was able to take some money off the table and look after my family. And so the fact that I saw it was possible, that kind of gave me hope. That I then started to look into the cycles. I've always been very good at pattern recognition. That's kind of been my speciality, has always been understanding and spotting patterns. So trading comes quite easy to me. And I think that there's two sides to everything. And I've seen this in every industry. You've got the veterans. And I used to do this when I used to build websites. I had a friend of mine in the industry who would build websites, and he was making millions a year building websites, because he was building these websites, spinning them up and getting them out very quickly, using WordPress as a template builder. I was custom coding by hand these websites, like one pixel to the left, one to the right. It's got to be perfect. I spent so much time and love and attention and care on one person's website, who paid me nothing for it, pretty much, that it wasn't very good business sense. And I learned it's the same in every industry. Game developers, traders, everyone feels threatened when somebody comes in and does their job easier with less effort and better. And so I was just making a lot of money, and I didn't really want to talk about it because I felt like I was an imposter. I didn't feel like I was a good trader. I wasn't a qualified trader, but I was making a lot of money out of it. And so I just kept my head down and just that's what I did.
And I guess the greatest learning is you made it, you lost it, you made it again. And now
I'm not losing it this time. Well, hopefully.
And I think that's the best place to start, right? When you know the pain, you've been through the pain, and you felt that, and you're not going to let it happen again. However, there are going to be so many people that haven't been through this cycle before. Maybe they're just starting in crypto. Maybe they're not even in that yet, and they're just listening to this thinking, I want to get into it. So let's talk crypto then, Steve. Let's start from the beginning. What is it? Let's define it in as simple terms as possible. What is crypto?
I mean, in its most simplistic form, crypto is just a form of encryption. I mean, that's all it really is. It's just a form of, it's a way to encrypt something. Now, what's happened since then, from how it used to be, you know, when I used to send secure communication messages, it was just a form of encrypting that message, so that, like Enigma, you know, we all know of that system. And so what happened is, using computing, it was a process was created. And the most simplistic and easiest way to explain this is, imagine an Excel or a Google sheet. And that is what is known as a ledger. And a ledger just it just transmits all of the transactions that happen. Now, you can't edit it. You can't change it. Once you've done a transaction, it's immutable. It's there for life. There's nothing you can do. It can't be intervened with. No human can change it. And that's the power, because we live in a world right now where there is so much distrust, I guess, for a better word, and lack of transparency. And so the ability to be able to create this transparent ledger that everybody can see, because the blockchain is available for everyone. So you can go online, you can see every transaction that's ever happened and ever will happen, and it's immutable, it can't be changed. So there's a lot of stuff happening in the world at the moment, and there's a very, I would say, interesting time ahead when we look at things like deepfake, when we look at things like what's happening with ownership and creation, like where are things being created from. And it can be anything from, if you look at fashion and you look at how clothing's made, if it's ethical and sustainable, all the way through to a presidential campaign and the votes. So when you look at the transaction history, can it be manipulated? Can it be altered? And can everyone see it? And in its fundamental essence, that's kind of what crypto has become now. It's become this ledger, and there's lots of different ledgers. I mean, Ethereum is one that many people know about. You know, Solana is another. These are basically just blockchains. They're ledgers. And then all of the transactions that happen within that ledger, it's like a Google Sheet. You can just go and you can view them all. And so there's power in that. Now, with that being said, Bitcoin, because that's what a lot of people know. A lot of people have heard and know Bitcoin. Bitcoin at the moment is going through, I would not an identity crisis, because Bitcoin knows exactly what it is, but how people identify it, that's where the crisis is at the moment, because people don't know what it is and they're trying to figure it out.
Some people refer to it as digital gold. What are your views on that?
So a lot of people refer to it as currency. Oh, Bitcoin is cryptocurrency, or it's a coin, or it's a currency. And Michael Saylor, who is probably one of the biggest maxis of Bitcoin, he's been buying the top and the bottom since, and he's got an incredible strategy that he's just found a loophole that he can take out debt against his, like you would release equity in a house. Yeah. So he's now releasing equity against his Bitcoin, using that to create debt to buy more Bitcoin through his company. He's created like this infinite loop where he can just continuously buy Bitcoin. And because of the terms, they're so favorable, he hasn't even got to repay it early. There's no fees. It's ridiculous. I think this week he's just borrowed another $800 million, I think.
And Michael Saylor, he's been buying from the top.
He's been buying from the top and the bottom.
Right throughout. He's just carried on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can see him being one of the richest people in the world. He's worth billions at the moment. And so when you speak to someone like Michael Saylor, or you listen to what he says, He said this very well yesterday. I was listening to an interview of his. He said, Bitcoin is like digital gold, in the sense that you wouldn't go down the street with your Bitcoin and try and buy a coffee, in the same way you wouldn't go down the street and try and use your apartment to buy a coffee. You know, there's some things which are assets. You know, your property, your actual physical property that you live in, is an asset if you own it. And so the way that I look at Bitcoin is, it's very much like a house, but it's digital. Not in a sense that I can live in it, but in the way that some people store wealth and value in their house. Like, I'll buy a house, and then if I sell that house, I'll get that money back, and it should retain its value. I kind of look at Bitcoin as digital gold. Like you said, it's a store of wealth. So it's somewhere where I can park my money. If I believe, which I do, that the fiat currency, whether it be the US dollar, the Great British Pound, where, because of purchasing power and inflation, I believe that the value of that currency will go down in time, as it has for the last 100 years.
I mean, our system is pretty
it's broken.
Wrecked. It's,
yes,
it's
yeah,
broken.
Pretty much. So you want to be able to park money. Like, where do you put it? Do you put it into paintings? Do you put it into companies? Do you put it into, like, where do you store your wealth in assets so that it can hold value? And that's kind of what Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is something that can't be taken away. It can be, I can send it to somebody on the other side of the world in seconds for no cost. You know, no one can come and take, confiscate it from me. So if you've got a property or a house, the government don't like it, they can find ways to take it away from you.
And I think
and
it's
so
a generational thing as well. Certainly in sort of my generation and, well, my parents' generation, you know, it was all about bricks and mortar, get a house, you know, put your assets in
absolutely
there.
Yep.
And the thing is, people could afford houses back then.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, that was how it was taught, right? It was my dad always called it the 40-year rule. So you work 40 hours a week for 40 years of your life, you know, and you retire on 40% of what you were worth or something like that. I can't remember what the third one was, but it was a 40-40-40 thing. And great. Like, I've nothing against that. You know, it was always like for my dad's generation, it was very much, you know, you bought your house, you paid off your mortgage. Congratulations, you've won life. Like, that was, you know, you get married, have kids, settle down, have a family, go
But
to work, get a
things
job.
have changed. They've
I don't
changed.
Think people want to do that anymore. People don't feel valued working in a traditional workplace. And after COVID hit, we saw it. People didn't want to go back into the office. Outsourcing and freelancing has allowed people from countries where there's no economic opportunities to be able to have economic opportunities. The world's changing.
And I think kids these days just can't simply afford a house. I mean, wages have actually dropped. Inflation's gone up.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, GDP
where would
is
you put it?
slowing and people aren't having babies anymore. We're pretty much fucked.
So where would you put
really,
it?
Society.
If you even had even, like, and this is the thing. First of all, have you even got any money to put away? And if you have, where do you put it? And this has been a challenge, right? Where do you store your wealth? Where do you put it? And so Bitcoin has created an opportunity right now. I mean, this is a you look in history at the dot-com boom, and you look at the things that have happened, you know, where you've seen the revolutions from, like, the industrial age to the technical age to, you know, whatever we are going through a generational revolution right now, where the boomers and the people that are holding assets are retiring or, you know, coming to the end of life. We've got the new generation that can't afford anything, and some of them don't want to. You know, there's definitely some disconnects. But ultimately, you've got this whole group of people who are just lost. They're just lost. They just don't know what to do and where to go and how to do it. And they don't trust the government. They don't trust the people around them. There's so many people out there that are trying to take from them that they don't have a lot to start with. It's overwhelming. It's just absolutely overwhelming. And so this is why I believe in Bitcoin, because there is no entity that controls it. There is no company behind it. There is no, even the founder stayed anonymous, which was the most incredible thing to do, because there's no ego. There's no, it's just, there's a very academic white paper that states what it should do. And then there are validators that just oversee the network to make sure it runs as intended.
So firstly, where can people get started? But I guess before they do, what are the pitfalls or anything they should look out for?
Of course. So at the moment, I mean, there's a very famous saying that, you know, when you're in competition, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then they join you. And so when I say that, I refer to Bitcoin as an asset class. And then I look at the government and how governments and traditional banking systems. Traditional banking systems right now they're on life support. They're struggling. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to die, because ultimately they do write the rule book for a lot of this.
Well,
you know, and we saw
it. They bail them out like they did in 2008.
Exactly. And so we saw what happened to subprime. We know what's happening. We're not stupid anymore. We're more connected than ever before. You know, before it was always happening, but we never saw it. Now with the internet and how connected we are with social media, we see a lot of it. We're a lot more aware. We're a lot more alert. And so I don't think people are going to put up with the same shit again. I think people are not, they're not going to fall for it in the same way. And so when I think about, like, when you mentioned what are some of the challenges, there's still the fear and the concern of government intervention. And we're experiencing this in the UK right now. If you go to your bank and try and put money into crypto, the bank will simply just reject it outright. They'll just say no. And they'll say, for your protection, we're not allowing you to deposit. And if you do just so happen to get money into crypto, you have to go through, I guess, the Spanish Inquisition, for a better word. I mean, you have to answer 10 to 15 questions on, you know, are you aware this is a risk? Do you know how dangerous this is? Are you aware you can lose what you like? It's fear, fear, fear. And it's just constantly putting fear into you to make you not want to do it.
I'm going to say I had exactly this when I first got into crypto a couple of years ago when I made my first little investment. And it wasn't a large amount of money. I'm with HSBC. I don't mind naming and shaming right now. And I tried to withdraw my money and put it into a crypto exchange. And they stopped it. They didn't just stop it once. They stopped it twice. I rang up and I said, look, this is me doing it. Because they said, is it you? Yes, it's me. They let it go through. And then I tried again. It bounced back. And in the end, I actually had to go into the branch and complain. And just as a little tip, do that. And I got some compensation as well. So you are in your rights. Remember, it is your money. It's not.
Is it?
In theory, it is the bank's money. But complain. Yeah, complain and make sure you get that transfer done.
Here's the thing.
If so many people sort of stick up for their rights, stick up for themselves, then eventually the banks will have to do something about it.
Well, here's the thing. People think that when they put money in a bank, that it's their money. It's my bank, it's my account, it's my money. As soon as you deposit money into the bank account, it is the bank's money. They promise they're going to give it back to you, but, and obviously under government regulation, you know, they have to a degree, but look, Northern Rock promised that they were going to give money to their customers. The Lehman Brothers promised they were going to give money to their customers. You know, promises are made to be broken. That's what happens. And so it's only a matter of time until the next bank falls. And so whilst I have a little bit of money in my bank just to be able to cover my living expenses, I don't like keeping money in my bank, because when you take into consideration just simply, you know, shrinkflation, purchasing power, inflation, like when you consider all of the elements on the economy, you're losing approximately 15% per year. If I put £1,000 in my bank account, then that is going to lose 15%. I'm going to at the end of the year, without touching it, that £1,000, even though it's still £1,000, it, like the numbers say 1,000, technically I've only got £850 now, because I can't do as much with it. And so you will lose money just simply by keeping it in cash. Now, it's good to have some money in cash, so you've got the flexibility to buy things. But if you have everything in cash, then your money's being chipped away. And we've seen it over the last 100 years. You know, this is a system that doesn't work. And so what Bitcoin is offering is a new way of thinking, a new way of transacting. And on top of that, the other thing I think is that when you look at any markets, markets are made by traditionally US dollars. So everything is based against the US dollar. And that makes sense, because every country in the world has its own export, you know, whether it's textiles, whether it's silicon, whatever the country may be known for. America is known for consumerism. I mean, it does other things as well, but they are the buying power of the world. They are the ones that were going around buying everything from the other countries. And they did it at such scale that everything was done in the US dollar. But should one country be in control of the global financial market these days? You know, why America? Why China? Why Russia? Why not something independent that isn't owned by anyone? Like, it makes so much sense to have Bitcoin as the standard of what we base our wealth on and against. And having it as a form of digital gold, like gold bullion, where it's finite, there's a limited amount, it's transparent, it's immutable. You know, you can send it to anyone in the world, anywhere, at any moment. It's fractionalized, so you can own a part of it. Because like you said before, you might not be able to buy a whole house, but what if you could buy one brick?
Yeah.
And what if you could just keep buying one brick every week until eventually you had a house? That's what Bitcoin is. You don't have to buy a whole Bitcoin.
It gives the opportunity for the debanked, the people in much poorer countries that actually can't get a bank account. So they can't move to the next level. They can't get educated. They can't go anywhere or do anything because they can't have a bank account. And it enables them to actually be able to sort of do something without having the banks.
Yes. Authority. And on top of that, look at how many overseas workers there are. People who use something like, for example, Western Union to send money. So people before would use Western money to Western Union to be able to send money home. So they would earn money in a country, they would use Western Union, they would send it home, and they would pay a fee for that process. Now you can do it instantly with no fee. Why would anyone ever use a service like that again? Like it, like we're going to see eventually, and that's just one side of it. We're looking at one side of it. On the other side of it, I mentioned earlier, look at deep fakes. How can I verify that you, Sonia, actually made that video that was trending on and went viral? How do we know it was you that made it? Well, using blockchain technology, a ledger, which is immutable, not as a store of wealth this time, but as a proof of this is me. I sign this transaction from myself to say that I did it. So this content, and it'll have a metadata, a timestamp. It will have information that will show. So you'll be able to verify that it was you that did something. And then that goes across to everything. The title deeds for your house, the MOT for your car, your health records, if you want them, that sort of thing as well. Even down to voting rights, you know, even down to charities. How are charities spending their money? You donate money to a charity. You want to be able to see, you want to be able to go online and view a transparent ledger.
So I guess that debunks the myth, and I'm aware we're off tangent now because we're telling people how to set up their crypto account. But I guess that debunks the myth of crypto is just for criminals, which is a big myth out there. You know, the media, maybe not so much now, but splash all around about, you know, terrorism, people, you know, using crypto because it was dirty money. It was a way for terrorism to sort of take place.
It's funny.
It's a load of rubbish.
I can't help but laugh at it because the irony here is that criminals and even terrorist groups have gone on record to say, don't send us crypto, because it's traceable. At the same time, cash is king in that sense. It always has been. Now, I don't think cash works though, because like the people that don't like crypto are the people that like cash, and the people that like cash are normally doing things they shouldn't. That's the fact. That's the reality of it. They're either avoiding tax. They're either avoiding tax, or they're not accounting for everything, or they're using it for illegal activities and they don't want to be seen. So the people who are doing things by the book, they don't care. I mean, we're already digital. You know, look at, like, I don't remember the last time I had cash. You know, if I go in somewhere and they don't take card, I'm confused, because I use contactless for everything. We all do. It's just convenient. We all value convenience.
It's the future, I think, whether people like it or not. So let's go back to where we were. How do people get started? So we've already sort of flagged that, okay, it is going to be difficult for you to transfer your money into a crypto exchange. What do people do once they do that? And are there more easier ways to do it than others?
Well, you've got to first understand that now you know that there's a ledger and there's a Google Sheet, which contains all the transactions, and there's different brands, if you like. Let's just, for the sake of simplicity, to not overcomplicate things, and I know not technically it may not be correct, but let's just say there are different brands. There's Ethereum, there's Solana, there's AVAX, you know, there's all of these different layer one, which is the top layer technologies. Now, if you take Ethereum, for example, as a layer one technology, as a network, people can use it, they can transact on it. But the more people that use it, the busier it gets. Now, one of the features, it's actually, I don't know if it's a fault or a feature, it's meant to be by design. The busier a network gets, the more expensive that network gets to use. And this is a big, big problem with Ethereum at the moment. And whereas if you used a bank card, like a Visa or a debit, a MasterCard, you have a transaction fee. You go in a shop, you buy something, you pay an extra 50p as a convenience to use the card. Well, all of these networks have the same thing, but it's called gas. So a gas fee is a transaction fee. And what that is basically doing is you're paying a fee, and that is going to the validators who are authorizing the transaction, not authorizing the transaction, sorry. They are verifying the transaction to be real. So what happens is you make a transaction from your computer or your device. It goes off to the blockchain. It then goes to lots of different validators, and they go, yep, that's a valid transaction. There's enough funds in that account. We're going to send them from one to the other. And anonymously, multiple different validators will anonymously verify this, and it will come back. They'll all be paid a little bit for their work, which is the computing power. And then it all goes through, and then it gets added to the block. So there's a big block of transactions, and they are all chained together. So blockchain, that's where the word comes from. So
and
what happens?
As we understand it, the blocks are about to be halved for Bitcoin. coming up in April. Well, we're recording this now, it's mid-March. So yes, the Bitcoin halving is scheduled for the next few weeks.
Well, that's a completely different thing to consider. So what I'm talking about with validation and the networks is one thing. Bitcoin halving, we'll go into that in a minute, is a completely different thing altogether. And we'll talk about that. But ultimately, let's just to finish off this cap with the networks. When a network gets too congested, that layer one, that top layer, like Ethereum, you have layer two networks. So we have Polygon-matic. There are things called ZK rollups now. There's lots of different brands, if you like, that are now layer two. And what they do is they're independent. So they do the transactions. You do all of the transactions. They go into a block, and then that gets submitted to the blockchain and verified. And then what happens is Ethereum, which is the layer one, will do it. And if it gets too expensive, you can use Polygon-matic, for example, and then that does a big block, and then it sends it to Ethereum. And by sending it in one go, it's cheaper to send. And so now people are starting to use these layer two networks. They're starting to create, there'll be private networks. Companies will have their own blockchains. You know, we're going to see blockchains kind of spin up in the same way that website servers do. You've got your shared blockchains, you've got your private blockchains, you know, you'll have your government blockchains. And we're in this state of discovery right now. We don't know what's going to be MySpace. We don't know what's going to be Twitter and Facebook. We're still in discovery of figuring out what's what. And everyone's fighting. Ethereum's the best. Solana's the best. AVAX is the best. Cardano, like, there's all conversations around who's using what for what. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Because, yes, all of these smart contracts, all of these networks, all of these builders, they're incredible in what they're doing. But not everything's going to make it. And we're going to see a lot of we're going to see a lot of failure. That's just unfortunate, but it's part of the growth cycle. But what we shouldn't see is Bitcoin fail. And going back to what you mentioned with the Bitcoin halving, the way that Bitcoin works, the way it's generated is miners, which are just computers have to solve mathematical equations. Every time they successfully solve a mathematical equation, they get rewarded with Bitcoin. That's known as mining Bitcoin. Now, computers have become extremely clever, and they've been made efficient now. So it's not like a home computer. It was found out a long time ago that the GPU, the graphic processing unit that does all of the graphics within a computer, is better at doing the maths than the central processing unit, the CPU. So if you know anything about computers, the GPU is better at doing maths equations than the CPU. That is why NVIDIA stock has gone through the roof. If you look at the stock market and you look at NVIDIA and you want to know why, it's because of mining, because it can do these mathematical equations for rendering and for things like that. And so now what you have is these dedicated farms, and we're talking like warehouses that are sucking the electric out of a small country. But it's also becoming more sustainable, because there's another argument that, oh, Bitcoin's not sustainable. Look at what El Salvador are doing. They're looking at using volcanoes to be able to power their Bitcoin farming.
A lot of the energy they're using anyway was wasteful energy.
There's hydro dams. There's a lot of stuff that's being used.
I think
now.
That debate is another one that's been blasted with the media to try and.
Of course, and there'll always be a narrative there. Yeah. But at the end of the day, what happens is these miners, they do these complicated calculations, and they get rewarded in Bitcoin. Now, when Bitcoin started, it wasn't very difficult to solve these, and there wasn't many people doing it, and your reward was a lot higher. So you were very easily, from a home computer, able to solve a maths equation, and you were rewarded with 50 Bitcoin. Now, every 4 years, as part of the white paper, the rewards that the miners get is halved. So 25, 12 and a half. We're going down now, next month, to 6.25.
And just so people understand how important that is, it's the law of economics, supply and demand. If something is more scarce, the value goes up.
Well, so... yes. And consider that there's a cap. You can at the moment, currently, you can only generate 900 Bitcoin per day. The miners cannot produce any more than that. There's a limit. And that is about to be halved.
Wow.
So we're only going... So. The demand is going up. People want it. People are becoming more aware of it. The governments are loosening up there. And even yesterday, the UK have reduced their stance on crypto. And they're going to, in April, there's new legislation that's passed in the UK to make it a little bit more, a little softer. And what we're going to start seeing now is the demand, because we've just had it with ETFs. We've seen institution money starting to come in now.
Yeah, let's just on that, on the ETFs. Now, I used to work in the city. I spent 17 years in the city. BlackRock, who are the biggest asset manager on the planet, they were one of my clients. Now, when the CEO, Larry Fink, gets up and talks in front of the world's press and says, this Bitcoin is worth something, you need to be looking at it. We're going to look at it. We're starting an ETF. Then you want to sit up and listen. And it's not just BlackRock, it's another 10
They're
institutions.
all fighting each other right now to try and get as much on their books as possible. And the thing is, here's the other thing as well. Previously, up until now, the people that have been buying Bitcoin has been retail and early adopters. And those are the people that are easiest to scare. You know, the market crashes, they sell. And they're not always as liquid. They're not able to hold on to that for like you not everyone's able to hold on to a 60 or a 70% drawdown for 2 or 3 years. Like they don't have the liquid ability to be able to do that. BlackRock don't care. They can hold on to it indefinitely. And so what you're going to find now is that a lot of the institutions that are buying these ETFs and buying this Bitcoin, they're not selling it. So now what's going to happen is the centralized exchanges, you're going to start to see them dry up. And I expect that in a not too distant future, you'll log into Binance or Coinbase or whatever app you want to use, you'll go to buy Bitcoin and you'll get a message that says, we're sorry, we don't have any Bitcoin available at the moment. Would you like us to email you when it becomes available?
I still don't think people, and I'm going to say in England and the UK, just because that's where we both are, Steve. I know in the US it is big news, but I don't think people really understand the ramifications of this, how big this has just become. I mean, you've been in crypto for so many years, but this institutional adoption of it, I mean, in terms of the whole TradFi industry, traditional finance. It's the ETFs has been the biggest or the most successful launch of any ETF, including gold, including everything else out there.
Crypto will consume every single industry in the world. It's just a matter of time. It will consume everything. It will become so integrated into our daily lives, it won't even become a thing.
Is it too late? If I'm an investor now and I'm like, wow, I love this,
No.
how do I get in? I've just heard Bitcoin's hit an all-time high. Is it too late for me to get into the market?